Welcome, everyone. You've tuned in to Beyond the Mic with Mike, where we share our experience and passion to offer encouragement and advice to new ministers and anyone working in the ministry. I am the Mike, Beyond the Mic, Mike Yates.
Today's episode, I've got Pastor Jonathan Arnold with me. We are going to be discussing AI in the ministry. He wants everyone to know he is UPCI's tech support. Later, I'll be giving you his personal cell phone and email and address. Please call him at all times of the day. That is very fictitious. Do not. He does not want to be tech support, but he is my tech support. He is the closest thing I have to an expert. John, go ahead and give everybody your credentials so they know why I've got you here.
Sure. So my name is Jonathan Arnold. Along with being an ordained minister in the United Pentecostal Church, I spent the last 25 years of my secular career in neural networking and then artificial intelligence, data science. I did start out as an engineer, and then I tell folks, you know, I was an engineer, but I've gotten the executive lobotomy. So what that does mean is it's, I do know lots about AI. I do no longer program. In fact, I'm not good at it at all anymore. And yet was an executive at IBM and IBM Watson, prior to that at Essential Software, designing, you know, large data arrays and neural networking for them. And then way, way back in the day, worked at Netscape in the early phases of you know, the commercial internet, and then rolling out a lot of advanced technologies in today that are just commonplace. Things like email and calendaring and websites and video conferencing, things that were cutting edge back in the, you know, mid and late 90s. So that's my experience.
Wow. Netscape. I've not heard of Netscape in a long time. For the young minister just listening, that's an old browser. That's one of the original browsers.
Indeed. It was the first commercial browser. Mm-hmm. It was the foundation of the commercial internet.
Yeah, that's... Oh, he just dated himself there.
Well, I have gray hair. I was a young man then. I'm not now.
And just... I know we're talking about AI, but go ahead and, if you don't mind, give us your ministerial credentials. How long have you been pastoring and whatnot?
I pastor Pensacola Beach, Gulf Breeze, Florida. I've been there for 15 years. Prior to that, I was the assistant in Schenectady, New York, and then the youth pastor before that. Graduated from a Bible college and Kent Christian College in Dover, Delaware, and was a skull full of mush before that.
Wow. So obviously, he's got a resume worthy of the podcast. He's got me beat. AI is here to stay. I've decided to use it. You know, my background's in cybersecurity. I have an IT background. John and I, we're going to be on a first name basis for the podcast. John and I, we're similar in that area. But I just want to give you the floor. Tell us, is it scary? Do we need to be scared of AI?
That's a good question. So I think the fundamental thing people need to know, and no matter where you're coming at this conversation or this technology from, you need to recognize it's just a technology. It's no different than, you know, the dawn of the tractor. When the tractor came out, folks farmed with horse and buggy or mule and plow and looked at tractors as something that would disrupt everything that was out there. It's got to be some evil device. While others looked at it as wow, this will free up my day. I can be more productive out of my field. And the answer is, the reality of that is both are true, right? It is going to disrupt the way that all of society works today, lives today, acts today, and for the future. And there's things that we've done in the past and we do now that we will end up not doing anymore or not doing the same way. So you need to know and be comfortable with the uncomfortableness that artificial intelligence is one of those societally changing technologies that will permeate everywhere. In fact, is already permeating most places. So that's number one. Number two is, like all technologies, it can be used for good or bad. The same engineering, the same machinery that makes a tractor is the same one that makes a tank. And sure. So which is good and which is bad? Well, it depends how it's applied and who is doing the applying. And that changes over time, and it's not universal. Right? We have good people using tanks and bad people using tanks, and good people using tractors and bad people using tractors. One can do harm and one can create. And so artificial intelligence, or, you know, in various phrases for the same type of thing, machine learning or, you know, active data science, whichever words you want to use, it's all about the application and who's applying it. And it will not succumb to any rigid rule set or definition. So we need to be comfortable that this thing is out in the world and it will never go away.
What exactly is AI?
Okay, I'm going to give a technical, geeky definition, and then I'll give an everyday common person definition, somebody who kind of knows something about it, but not really.
Okay.
So technically, artificial intelligence isn't. It isn't intelligent and it isn't artificial, right?
Gotcha.
But it does a really good job of fooling us that it is on purpose, right? And when I say it, the technology fools human beings because other human beings have crafted it to function and look like a human being would respond. But what it really is a combination of data science, understanding large volumes of information in their context, in their own context, and in the large set of context of human knowledge, the same way that you would have an academic or just somebody who loves to read and understand a particular subject, artificial intelligence is fed that information and understands it in the context. It understands being a big air quote statement in that it doesn't really understand. It just knows the rules and fabric of knowledge, and it's designed to process it like a human brain does. It literally, there is software-based human psychology inside artificial intelligence systems, right? Human beings built that. And then on top of that, there is now, and I say now, and just in the last 5 years, it's been invented. In the last 2 years, it's become useful. And now in the last 6 months, it's become almost spooky scary, are things called general transformers, right? And so GPT is, you know, the phrase people know. What those are really sophisticated guessing engines. And what that means is the same that way that as I'm speaking, you're thinking what word is coming next, what sentence is coming next. That's what a GPT does. It uses that knowledge of information and it makes guesses and strings ideas together and predicts them. And then from that prediction, it goes back, adds that prediction to all the things that's already known or said, and looks and makes the next guess and the next guess. And it's really good at guessing, the same way that a human brain is. So that's today's version of artificial intelligence. And I won't get into the spooky stuff that's, you know, being worked on or even self-developing at this moment. But that's what artificial intelligence really is. It's data science with human software that's been programmed so that the computer asks questions itself of the data and comes up with answers in a way that a human being would think about them, right? So that's the geeky statement about artificial intelligence without talking about programming modules and you know, ASICs and all those things. Now, to the general person, what artificial intelligence is a little bit different. It is a machine in the sky, a thing in the sky, in the cloud, via your phone, via your internet browser, via, you know, some machine that's actually plugged into it. And it is asking it specific questions about what it has to do for a living. For example, if you have a network of traffic lights and it is also that artificial intelligence engine is also plugged into the traffic that's happening at the moment, it can say the traffic signals can say, what's the best way to optimize traffic for the next hour, given the normal traffic flow and the real traffic flow we have today, and the general purpose transformer, the GPT that understands traffic, will go change the lights and optimize them so that traffic routes the fastest and safest. There's an application of artificial intelligence that can be used in a positive way. Or I've used artificial intelligence to act like an English teacher or an editor. I've written articles and I tend to be wordy and speak a lot like the Apostle Paul, where I add a lot of parenthetical phrases that make hard people, you know, jump back and forth. My ADD gets involved. And I've taken that article and I fed it to ChatGPT or to Grammarly, which is an AI engine, and say, edit this for content and clarity and brevity. And it will take my 1,000-word article and spit it back to me in 750 words and get rid of my parenthetical phrases and make my sentences flow properly. There is an artificial intelligence engine, but it's not intelligent. It's using what we have trained it to do instead of programmed, We've trained it on top of the programming to act in certain ways, and its actions make a bunch of computer software function like a human brain does. That's what AI really looks like out in the wild. Out back in the cage, it looks a whole lot different.
Sure. It's only as good as the database that's in it, right?
Well, good is you know, a subjective term.
Sure.
Its output is only as good or truthful as the data that's into it. And that's really key. And not just the data that's into it, but what it's weighted with, because not all information has the same truthfulness to it or importance. And just as we as humans bring to information, past information, past knowledge, and a judgment about of importance, those that train AI put weights on the knowledge that comes to it. So one AI may come up with a different answer, even with the same data, because the person training it has put a different weight on the importance of certain authors or subjects.
I know as the database has its limitations, because I tried to upload a picture of myself and it told me I needed to lose weight. It said it couldn't handle a file that size. I tried to tell it, chat, do I look good? And it says I cannot fathom that concept. So there's some limitations to the database. It still needs to work. What can a ministry use it for?
Well, firstly, let me say there's more than one AI engine out there. The most known one today is ChatGPT, but there are...
That's a good point.
There are multiple out there that are used for specific purposes.
Right.
So for example, Midjourney, the entire purpose of Midjourney is graphical, and it is the best graphical generating AI on the market at the moment, in my personal opinion. There are others that are purpose-built for different industries, like healthcare, or the company that I work at now is purpose-built AI for energy products, oil and gas, and methanol, and ammonia, et cetera. And so specific use AI is important. But if we stick to what's mostly available to folks, that would be OpenAI or ChatGPT, or a version thereof, like through Microsoft's add-on, the name that just escaped me, I apologize.
A Copilot?
Copilot, thank you. Yeah, so Microsoft has it on there. Meta, the Facebook-owned, the company that owns Facebook, has got their own, and it's purpose-built for social media and advertisement and whatnot. Google's AI is quite good, but heavily biased at the moment.
Very.
That's not a political statement. It's biased in many ways.
Right.
Oracle's AI is built for companies. It's not built for general people. Same for IBM's. It is highly, highly useful in a wide variety of applications, but it's not meant for, you know, Joe Public to ask questions of it. It's built for, tell me how to optimize the engine efficiency of an automobile, or the thermodynamic usage of a nuclear power plant to generate power.
What makes you think I don't want to know how to?
Yeah, well, you might.
Yeah, come on, give me some credit.
So, you know, and to your question about, you know, you can't upload a file. Well, that's a limitation because the company that owned that AI doesn't want to use up all the processor because that costs money. So they put some limits on it. So yeah, there are limitations that are put on it by the people that own those systems, and or they just haven't figured out how to do stuff yet. So that, you know, that's important. How can a minister use it, to get to that question? Well, I would say the same that a person can, to educate yourself about things in a very rapid fashion. And so if you ask questions of AI on a subject, the beauty of it is it's already read libraries of information and knows where to find answers, and can not only tell you an answer in short form, you can instruct it how to answer you, not what the answer is, but for example, when I am doing an article or I'm doing some research on for either work or for a sermon or a class, I always tell it, give me citations, right? So ask the question and cite your references. And that way, it not only will tell me those references, it will give me links so I can actually go read the source material myself.
Sure.
So, for example, I was teaching a class for my local church, and I needed some help creating material. So I created graphics, slides for the class that I'm not that artistic. So it generated it for me. But beyond just the grunt work, I asked it questions about psychology. I asked it questions about what would be a good outline to teach this lesson. I gave it my material. It gave me back an outline. And then I asked it, you know, can you tell me details about item number three and cite some sources that I could quote? In that case, I was actually teaching about creation and different models of creation, talking about the pre-flood earth and scientific articles referencing. GPT, ChatGPT in that case, went back and found those sources for me instead of me spending hours on Google trying to find them. It gave me references, quotes, scientific names, articles, links to NASA and to the National Geological Survey, some European systems, some university white papers, all there before. Saved me hours of searching and days of work. I still had to do the hard work of putting together the class material, formulating what I was going to say. And yet it was a shortcut, but it didn't keep me, it wasn't doing the hard work for me. It was doing the grunt work for me.
Sure.
That's the way we really need to think about it is AI is augmenting my intelligence instead of replacing my need to know.
Exactly. Go fetch this encyclopedia for me.
Well, even more so, I don't know what encyclopedia. Go find this data for me and tell me where you found it. That's highly valuable.
I will say just that chat is not perfect. It does make a mistake. And lately, just the other day, I asked chat to give me sources and it told me network error. So they're still working on things.
Oh, yeah. It's a computer. It's a machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't rely on it until... You know, don't try to use it at the last minute thinking it's going to give you, do all the work for you. You need to treat it as a machine that
absolutely
work, but might have a hiccup.
Absolutely. And that's just the IT guys in us telling machines will always be machines.
Right.
So never, ever put all your faith in a machine. One of the things I've used it for recently was I use a note-taking app on my phone. I use Simple Notes because it's free and it replaced Evernote because Evernote lost their minds and increased their rates ridiculously. And I sent them and never mind. That's not relevant. So I use Simple Notes and I was working on a thought and I would constantly add these events, whatever. And when I got ready to write the message, I had 20 to 30 different lines, but they were out of order. And I wanted them in chronological order and I couldn't remember. I copied and pasted and said, chat, please put these in chronological order. And it did because they were real events here. And that just saved me a lot of time because I was just taking notes on things that had happened, whatever. And, you know, find me scriptures for these, you know.
And that's very, very useful. I did do one thing, speaking of finding scriptures, instead of using it, you know, just as a scripture search engine. You know, the Bible is, I think Jordan Peterson said, it's one of the world's first hyperlinked documents. Something like 62,000 interlinks between scriptures and each other.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And... you know, while I have some very expensive software that I use for Bible study, it doesn't do that. I certainly can go from scriptures and click on them, but giving me the array of all of the references in the New Testament to Psalm 22, or which is, you know, David prophesying about the cross, yet it sounds like he's complaining about his own life because he was,
right,
not knowing he was prophesying about the cross. Well, give me the details around that and you know, interlinking from there to, as we would expect, Isaiah 53 and, you know, Luke 20:23 and whatnot, but showing not just these are where they talk about the cross, but the links to the specific verses. I'm here at your church here in DeWitt, and I've got a handout that shows all the interlinks from the book of Daniel and him laying out what shall be at the end of ages, as the angel tells him, and then the links to all of those exact same references in the book of Revelation. So, you know, you can ask it to do some interesting things there. You do need to go check it because its knowledge is based on what prior human beings have written. And as we know, the state church and a whole lot of folks that may or may not know certain things or believe like we believe or have some things wrong, those are in its corpus of knowledge, its body of knowledge as well. And so you need to go check and make sure it knows what it knows and is telling the truth. And if you don't know, you need to check it, right? You really need to go do the work because it isn't intelligent. It's spitting back answers in a way that sound intelligent.
I had used it. I'm just giving another example of how I used it. I did a study on Palm Sunday. I wanted to know why they use palm branches. You know, we always talk about they wave palms, but why? It's actually symbolic. And I was able to take it and kept asking it, why? Explain that more. Give me resources. Give me citations. Give me your sources. And it was very fascinating that it was able to do that. And then I saw real quickly, and this is what I taught my staff members, we can become addicted to this. We can lose all willingness to do any kind of study on our own because I was tempted, just out of curiosity, I told it, I want a Bible study. I want to do a sermon on, and I picked on forgiveness, and it drafted a sermon on forgiveness. I was like, oh, that's dangerous. If there's a lazy minister out there. So,
yeah, let me talk to that. So this is a little bit about my experience. When I first came to my town to start the church there, I was working full-time at IBM. I was traveling a good 200,000 miles a year for the job. I'd get home, you know, on Friday afternoon, wash my laundry, go knock doors, hand out flyers, et cetera. Saturday, set up the school cafeteria to become our church on Sunday morning, spend a little time with my family, too little time with my family on Saturday afternoon. Go back to praying and studying, you know, Saturday night to make sure everything was in place and sermon was really, really polished and working my slides. And then Sunday morning, go, you know, have service, then break everything down and, you know, get back to the house, have lunch, kiss the kids and wife, get back on the plane to go someplace else in the world, rinse and repeat. And I talked to a friend of mine. I went to Bible college with him. He was pastoring. And I told him, you know, I'm just wearing out. And he suggested to me to sign up for one of those, you know, sermon databases, paid $200 a year for it.
SermonCentral.com.
I don't think it was that one, but yeah, something like that. And it struck me in that moment that, you know, that's a good shortcut answer. And the Holy Ghost convicted me, and I'm thankful for it. And I called him back a couple days later. I said, I don't think I'm going to do it. And here's why. Because if I don't do the digging, and I don't let the word do its work in me, then number one, I'm just there reading.
Yeah.
Right. I might be able to put the emotion behind it and I might be able to, you know, fool the people, but I'm not fooling the Lord. And it's certainly not going to grow anything.
Right.
And that was that same problem, only worse, happens with AI, because we think we've done work by asking a question. And it's no different than taking somebody else's message and simply being the repeater of it. Only worse, because no one has gone and done the digging to get that information, get the word of God. It hasn't affected any heart, let alone your own. And so there is no room for laziness in being a minister. Now, that doesn't mean I can't use AI, like, but I still need to get out there in that field and do the digging.
Not to get off the subject of AI, but to stay on that thought, don't we teach people that that God blesses the results, some of the efforts, and he provides the results? That's what I always taught my folks. You know, we're responsible for the effort.
Yes, but that doesn't mean we have to do dumb effort.
No, exactly. Right. So if we use AI too much in the wrong way that I'm speaking of, I'm not, yeah. Well, I mean, work smarter, not harder.
That's right. The kingdom of God is people.
Right.
And when we take us as part of the people out of the equation, there can be no fruit that comes from it.
So if I don't put forth the effort in the word, then there's nothing for him to bless.
Right. Now, the other side of that, no, I'll say this a little bit.
We're on the same page. I'm just warning you.
Yeah, I know. But I don't mean this in any way arrogantly, but there are some folks. So I've always been known as the library. In my brain, I've got all this stuff stored away and I can piece things together. People call me and ask me about this or that. And yes, that strokes my ego a little bit, but on the other side, those air quote special people who understand this and that number of people will now exponentially grow because of AI. The person who hasn't read 10,000 books can still find those answers using AI. And that's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
It is a very good thing. And so while folks like me that may have read multiple thousands have always been, you know, felt like, okay, this is my niche in the world. It's not my niche. My niche is to be minister of the gospel, a representative of the kingdom. And the fact that I've got that in me has been helpful for the last 30 years. It's no longer the differentiator. And that's all right.
Yep. That's a very good point. To get back on the main point of AI in the ministry, I want to give some examples. And I believe that later on, not today, but you and I may do a demonstration and we could videotape that and we could show folks how to do things. You're right. I neglected. There are different AIs out there. I know Copilot can create PowerPoint slides. That's helpful for people that still do PowerPoint slides. You just throw your notes up there and it'll, although I had a hard time, it gave me links that didn't work just this week because I was trying it. So you may have to play with it. There are avatar AIs. That's really intriguing to me. I pictured giving a Bible study and then using a video avatar to present that in Spanish or some other needed language. Can you give me some other examples of things like that, ways that we could use AI in the ministry that we haven't already talked about?
Yeah. So those are two great examples. Very useful. If the Apostle Paul had what we have at our fingerprints today, you know, fingertips today, imagine, you know, but the Apostle Paul, who had access to YouTube, Facebook, and TikTok, and with AI to go not only preach in Greek and Hebrew, but to be able to preach in Portuguese. And I mean, those are fabulous examples, and we should not discount them. Beyond that is actually getting your content, right? The thing that you're trying to do to people. AI is actually very, very good. You have to go learn how to do this or use a tool that knows how to do it, then you got to learn that tool to get your content out there. You know, in the web world, we would say SEO, you know, to do tagging and whatnot. Well, AI goes a little bit further and finds who is the receptive audience to what you're looking for. And that's not just saying this person self-declares that they are looking for help with drug addiction. I'm going to tell you some scary things about AI. It can tell things about people that they don't tell anybody. It can tell if you are in the type of conversations or cabal that's indicative of a drug user or a person that's addictive. It can tell via Facebook if you've got credit problems, not because it's looking up your credit score, but the things you talk about, the verbal cues that you give, computers never tire. And so therefore it's able to look through this vast trove of information very quickly and derive things about you at the moment. Well, somebody producing content or wanting to reach individuals can leverage that to get to those types of individuals for good or bad, right? And deliver not just your content, but deliver customized content that person is able to receive or act upon, right? So there's one really high level, and I know probably a lot of people are listening like, oh, I could never do that. Well, you might not be able to alone, but you get four or five people together and put some work behind it, and then the machine will do the work that you directed to do. Now you can really do something there. Another good example would be, you know, optimize my bills. You know, we were talking, you know, offline earlier that, you know, when we go to Bible college or seminary, they teach us how to preach. They teach us how to teach, you know, maybe perform other functions. What they don't teach us is how to manage a nonprofit organization, how to raise money, how to pay bills, how to minimize bills. Well, AI is now at the point where you can say, you know, here's all of my expense for my phone bills, electric bills, water bill, et cetera. Give me ways in which I can reduce my overall costs. And it'll make suggestive answers for those. So there's real functional things you can do with it. And then from a ministry standpoint, imagine this, you've preached a message on Sunday and you have some main points that you've called the congregation to respond to and live out. Now imagine taking your sermon, feeding it to AI and say, give me a lesson plan for the home groups where they can extrapolate upon this and have conversations about them and help you derive material that now can be put in the hands of other people. You don't have to personally create 10 pieces of collateral, to use the commercial term, in order to be hand to people. Now you can create your source and create a AI template to generate the type of collateral you'll need for your home groups. It could do those types of things and take some of the burden off of us.
Great. While you were talking, I was taking some notes, things I wanted to bring up. You mentioned work. If you put work behind it, that's key. We're not, because AI is not here to do all the work for us. You do have to work AI. You mentioned SEO. I'm going to put two and two together here. I have you down here to do an end time class for us. I created a Facebook ad. In order to do that, I had to create a Facebook page because our church doesn't have a page. We have a group. I prefer the group management style over a page. So I created a Facebook page so I could do a Facebook ad. There was not an option to market that ad to this zip code. Facebook gave me options on how, who do you want to, you know, how do you want to promote this ad? My choices were automatic, let it decide or choose, and none of the other options were really appropriate. I'm not selling the product, you know, so I let it choose. And by doing that, what it did was it chose people that it knew would respond to the link. That didn't help us none. I spent $50 so people in Texas and Oklahoma could respond and cuss me out.
Yeah. So, and that's Meta's model or mode.
Yeah.
Number one, to those that are listening, I would recommend you shouldn't really ever spend more than $25 on a Facebook ad. My daughter is the head of the Chamber of Commerce, excellent at social media. She actually ran the second largest tourist event in Pensacola for many, many years. And so she figured out in that process how to tweak that advertising model. You can ask ChatGPT or Google or others to do the same for you. What are the settings I need to optimize my ad in this area in the Facebook platform, right? Literally ask it the question that way and coach you along. So that's, I would recommend that. The second is, as you're saying, Facebook is trying to figure out who to advertise to. But it's actually looking to spend your money as fast as it can.
Yeah, right.
Why it's advertising in Texas, et cetera, et cetera. And I've experienced that. I've spent hundreds of dollars over the years with Facebook ads. I will say only one of them ever bore fruit, but I know others that it's been very successful. So it does depend. Now, I pastor a small church with several large churches around me, so I do know others have gone to their churches based on my ad. So, you know, all right, be that as it may, I'm not in competition. But it's trying to figure out how to spend money with people that won't, that have looked at similar ads and responded to them. So it's what its model is as opposed to your model.
Right.
There isn't, in my knowledge, a social media system that is geared toward churches today. They want people that spend money. Churches try to not spend money.
Right.
They look for transactions to happen for businesses as opposed to a member of a church. So just keep that in mind. If this, it's not valuable. It is. The other thing is that most churches don't understand something about marketing, that it takes 17 touches of an individual with a marketing interface or touch for the person to act. That doesn't mean fulfill. It means even begin moving, unless there's some compelling reason to act. The second is that it's about 24 to 28 touches for, use the word for marketing, a marketing convert. That's not the same as actually making a convert in church, but in the door, participating with the function that you want them to participate with. That's an expensive proposition for a church.
Absolutely.
Unless you're doing, you know, general weekly advertisements. The purpose of advertisement is top of mind awareness, or TOMA. And so you should, if you're going to use social media and AI to generate that, understand, firstly, I want everybody to know who we are. And when they think of us like this. If it's, you know, put a coin in and get a coin out, that's not the way that marketing works. Whether it's AI driven or whether it's manual, or you go pay an advertising agency, or in one case, you know, I spent $3,000 on a radio ad, and, you know, did an interview with the radio station, which was nice and dandy and made me think I was doing something, and nobody showed up.
Mm.
It's not because they don't like us. It's because they're being human beings. And it would be the same way unless I said, we're having a barbecue at 3:00. Come and get food. Well, now people are like, there's food. I'm coming.
Right.
Right. So, you know, you have to have a different mindset when you think about those things. On the artificial intelligence side, though, use AI to help you optimize your spend, optimize your action, optimize your reach, as opposed to taking Facebook's recommendations, and I'm not against them, but you know, their job as a company is utilize those pennies as fast as they possibly can, right? Sure. What they don't want is anything in your budget left over before that time runs out.
And you illustrated my point was you cannot just click automatic and expect it to. You actually have to put some work in, understand, and do your. You have to know what you're doing, or ask AI to help you with that. You can't just. I learned that the hard way. I didn't think about using AI to help it with that. I just saw that there were no, and I thought I would get something close, but no. And I wound up actually stopping the ad early when I realized, okay, this is fruitless.
I run ads fairly regularly, about every other month, and I did use AI to optimize my zone. So I put in the names specifically where I want. So I've got Pensacola Beach, Gulf Breeze, and then within 10 miles, because the geographic area I am is very small, or water, chill, water trapped. So, and I used to get people, you know, hitting it from Idaho and California and whatnot. And now I rarely see any interaction outside of at least, 20 mile zone.
I can't believe you're not reaching for Atlantis and Aquaman. Yeah. You're out in it. Shame on you.
I do want to talk. I want to make sure we cover something called weighting, right? I mentioned it earlier.
What kind of weight? Spell it.
Oh, well, W E W.
Like the weight?
Like
mass?
Yeah, mass, fat.
Okay.
Right. So, what I mean by that is, well, we just had this example. Google had to shut down their new AI because they had loaded it with, wokeism. And so much so that we had, in there, if you asked a question of, paint me a picture of Nazi stormtroopers, and it came up with, black and lesbian Nazis, right? Which the Nazis would have killed.
Right.
It asked a question about celebrating something, and it would be the antithesis of that, but matching the model of a woke character. So they had weighted the system so hard that the system lied to itself and others. And that's simply because the answer is always going to come heavy on one side as opposed to the other. Every AI system out there has some weighting to it. And the goal is to get some truth or some diversity or some taking out of the crazies, because there's a whole lot of crazies out there. But what can end up happening is the bias against alternatives. For example, right, what we believe and hold absolutely true is what the apostles taught, right? I spoke at an event in front of our local Catholic Monsignor and talked about who we are as a church. And I said, our church is one of those where Peter and Paul and Polycarp all would have felt very comfortable. And his eyes widened because he understood what I meant by that. Polycarp, while he's considered a saint in the Catholic Church, his writings are considered not quite canon and not wholly acceptable because they're so apostolic. And so we need to recognize that even, in the 200s and 300s, when Tertullian wrote against Praxius, he was writing against, as he said, the majority of the churches believe elsewise than what I'm telling you. And he was right. There were only 8 churches in all of Christendom at the time that believed what Polycarp taught, or that Tertullian taught. And yet he wrote it as if he was, this great person and whatnot. But he admitted the majority of churches do not believe this. And so, yet that is now orthodoxy, has been since Nicaea, what Tertullian wrote. In fact, so much that Augustine, created this monstrous heresy built on that and, Roman paganism turned into Christian naming. And so there's a vast weighted material around that ideology of Christianity and the offshoots from it. Even Protestantism still comes from that base. That's not our base. Our base is precedes that or is counter to it. And so if you ask AI about apostolic teachings, well, plenty of people have called themselves apostolic that weren't.
Right.
Right. There was a group of a cult in the 1300s called the Apostolic Brethren. And while they did believe in pre-tribulationalism, they believed that their head, Brother Dominic, was, the second appearing of Christ, right? So we got to be a little careful, about what language we use, because that language has been co-opted and used elsewise, and it weights the answers, right? It moves the balance from one side to the other. There is a way to counter that, though, right? So it's a, there's a thing, the phrase currently being used, I think it will change, is called grounding, where you tell whatever particular AI engine, here is the basis of the way you're going to think about the data that's in your library, your data set. And you give it some boundaries. And so I did one. I posted it on a couple of different sites where I didn't really teach it about what does it mean to be apostolic. I pointed to it. This is the basis when we define being apostolic, when we define being Christian, we define church history. It's this church history, not that church history, right? I just taught yesterday here at your church about this new notion. It's very new that they're the rapture theory that, you know, this guy in the 1830s named John Darby came up and invented the rapture theory, and that didn't exist in quote unquote the church before then. And our answer has to be, which church are you talking about?
Right.
Right. Because as I showed to the class yesterday, right, 18 different examples, historical documents where major proponents of the church or a church throughout history, and it wasn't by no means comprehensive, taught about a pre-tribulation taking away of the church before the wrath of the Lamb, before the wrath of God, before the day of the Lord. It certainly was not new. And in fact, John Darby references several authors in the prior century, including, you know, like Cotton Mather here in the U.S. and a number of Methodist ministers. The Quakers were completely pre-tribulationist in the 1700s. So if you tell AI, if you ground it in the way of thinking, then it will start to answer in that model. It won't lie. Well, it won't lie. It won't knowingly lie unless you tell it to. It will if you tell it to. But if you give it the framework of its answers, the way in which it should process and investigate the library it has, much like we would look at it in a way that says, I know they said this, but what about that? And then you'll get answers that follow in that framework. So when I created Apostolic Answers on top of ChatGPT, it was simply a function of grounding ChatGPT with a truly Pauline, Peterian, Polycarp mindset. And I did feed it or pointed to some academic writings that it may not have weighted as heavily. Certainly, it knows, ChatGPT knows who David Bernard is. It knows who, slightly, not a lot, knows who David Norris is. It knows who Andrew Urshan is. I did point it to some of the things I had written, some of the things that Witherspoon had written. And those give it a framework to have its own internal dialogue with, and then read Augustine the way that Polycarp would and say, man, this guy's a heretic. All right, right. And so, and it's certainly still got to learn more. So understand, we as apostolics, we need to write, right, not just preach. We need to write. If we want the world in 150 years to know what we believe, we got to write it down. And it's got to get into the public sphere, literally, not just try to copyright everything and go make a nickel off of it. Try to make it available so that ChatGPT and Copilot and Google and Oracle and IBM and everybody else can go pluck that off the internet and add it to its body of knowledge, which will get proliferated around the world.
Well, you just, that last sentence there, because I was going to mention your Apostolic Answers, because it's a wonderful tool. It is why I pay $20 a month for ChatGPT 4.0. I was going to talk about grounding, how you have to ground your GPT, but you mentioned that. Now, lately, they have updated 3.5 to have a memory. It can remember your conversations. And when I first started using ChatGPT, it couldn't.
Right. The paid version does, right?
Right.
The paid 4.0 and 5.0 will.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've added, and I mean, we say memory. All that really means is it's keeping a record in its database of the conversation. It's not sophisticated, but it does cost them money to keep that data stored. It's useful. It's very useful because I've asked it questions about chemical processing that are pretty complex, and it's gone through iterative steps and whatnot. So me being able to pick that conversation back up with GPT, it's worth that $20 a month. Now, you don't, and I would like to, I'm poor, but I would like to actually front end that with a web front end so that anybody can come to it and not have to pay in order to get access to it. If I use the API, then it's charging me instead of charging you. And that's ideal, right? Instead of having 100 people pay $20 a month to OpenAI to get the same answer that I've already, but ideally that's what we would do. And I encourage, there doesn't just have to be one source. We have a problem in our organization that we want one source for everything. Look, I'm a believer in that. Let's get as much written out there and as much as accessible in 100 different ways, as long as we're not all vying against each other. Let people go where they're comfortable with.
I will, one frustration I'm having with 4.0 at the moment is I keep getting rate limited. There is a limit. I don't know what it is, but there is a limit how many questions you can ask.
Yeah, there is. And part, well, especially if you're creating slides, you know, one of the issues that people don't understand is the cost of compute for AI is extreme. It is by no means environmentally friendly. A GPU, you know, the processor type that they use, are incredibly electrically intensive, and it's just getting larger and larger, right? You know, ChatGPT has tens of thousands of those things running at the same time. It's, you know, they have their own power plants or power facilities, generators to feed them, big monstrous things. And they're going to buy tens of thousands more, billions of dollars worth of processors. Every question you ask it costs them at least a nickel or more. So it's not that they're, you know, just trying to squeeze something out of you. There's a real cost behind all of this. Now, on the other side of that, let me say, you know, Apple is coming out with on the phone AI. So literally using your ARM chip on your phone to do part of the pre-processing and then part of it, you know, feeding the back end to Apple. Meta is trying to leverage the phone's processor with its own back end AI. Tesla's model is fantastic, right? It actually has a mesh network across every system and device that it makes so that, you know, the load is spread out. Plus their own proprietary AI chips, which are monstrous. The most important thing in that, though, we need to understand, there has never been a technology revolution that has happened as fast as this, ever, right? As fast as the internet took off from 1995 to 1999 to become a full commercial viable entity, the technology advancement and rapid pace of the technology advancement of AI in the last 7 years, when, you know, Watson was answering Jeopardy questions and everybody was wowed by it, that system was like a kindergartner compared to today, right? Now we have PhD level AI and beyond. It's truly creative. We need to understand that we're still in that upward curve, that exponential curve of technology advancement. So you're not, if you become an expert today without a general knowledge of AI, you are obsolete 6 months from now, you know, right? And so any of the frustrations we're having is because we expect it to be perfect, not realizing that what we have today is basically a fifth grader in the development of where it's going. So expect it to change, expect it to be ugly, expect it to have some breakage and do things that amaze you.
You were comparing it to Watson. I heard someone say just recently, I don't remember where, but a few years ago, AI could not pass the bar exam, and it could not pass a doctor's licensing exam, but now it can.
Yes.
It
can write a thesis.
Yeah, just by learning.
Yeah.
It's learned.
Let me just talk to that. So that sounds amazing to us, but that's simply knowing how to answer a question of a very fixed set of information. Where AI should amaze us is where we ask an open-ended question that's not fully formed, where there's not a fixed answer, and it creates options for us, right? Like a human being would, like an expert would. AI is starting to be able to do that, and that's pretty amazing. Self-driving, that is people are acting like, you know, it's no big deal. We've been expecting it for years. That's really hard to make a machine, a robot, because that's what a self-driving car is. It's a robot that a human goes in. That's a really hard thing. Think about the number of accidents that people get into and the very few number of accidents that those self-driving cars are in comparatively per number of cars on the road. I know they all make the headlines because it's something new, but the massive number of compute functions and choices just in driving around an orange cone are obscene, but you as a human being never notice it because you're used to that world. no computer lives in the world, and today, for the first time, they're starting to. That is an amazing technological advancement. There's no right answer, and yet come up with an answer. Human beings have been used to that since, you know, Adam was formed in the garden. Computers never were until just now.
Let's talk about, again, my expertise right now is in cybersecurity. Tell me about some security risks of AI.
Okay, so I sit on the board for Cybersecurity Center, University of West Florida, NSA Cybersecurity Hub, ran cybersecurity for IBM Cloud for many years. So I know much, much more than I should.
Right.
My greatest fear is not what others have, that, you know, it's going to turn into Skynet or something like that. My greatest fear of AI is that we will use AI as a security mechanism on both sides of the divide. So one AI will start by fighting another AI and get carried away. And then we as human beings will try to unplug one or the other. And that while those two AIs are countering each other's threats, it will see us as a third threat in the middle. That's my big fear, that you know, it doesn't happen because somebody said, go kill everybody. It's because two AIs are trying to kill each other and we're some new threat introduced in the mix. So I mean, let's just say that's the apocalypse version, right?
Right.
We're nowhere close to that, but it might come faster than we think, right? So that's the one side. The bigger thing is I know some really good hackers, right? White hats, right? They get paid to be ethical hackers, red team, blue team type hackers. As creative as they are, they can't be as fast in their creativity as AI. And so one of the things that students that are being taught now to do is leverage AI as the force multiplier in their protective capability and in their red team threat creation capability. Because you better believe that folks in certain nation states are using AI, and I'm saying this as a known fact, not a postulation, using AI to advance the, I was going to use a whole lot of industry terms, advance the threat matrix, the surface, the threat surface that they can go after. And then, you know, I could tell you all sorts of stories of what humans have done in order to get into things in ways you didn't expect, not just to get into your computer by hacking your Wi-Fi, but hacking a thermostat and then using the thermostat to get into your network and then to get into your bank account from there. The ability to imitate a human being, AI is there.
Yeah.
Right? Voice, speech patterns, facial features. If it has a picture of me, it can put me on Zoom and have my voice and my voice pattern and my way of speaking. And you simply type in what you want it to say, and it will come up with a speech pattern and sentence like I would say it, with my face moving and indistinguishable from really me.
Right.
And so if I was to say to my CFO, I need you to authorize payment to XYZ company and do it, and my CFO says, give me, you know, your child's middle name, AI will go out and look up one of my children's middle names and provide it to the CFO, and away we go. Right. And that's happened, by the way.
Yep.
So, you know, there, it doesn't even have to be something super sophisticated. That can be done with, you know, $20 worth of SaaS software that you can sign up for on your phone today, right? So there's real issues beyond, you know, the cool stuff in the movies of, you know, getting in past the router on this. And, you know, that's all easy. That's past stuff. And if, look, the most important thing is that we, from a cybersecurity standpoint, we have control of our accounts. We don't have easy passwords. I will tell you, I use a password manager, and all mine are, you know, automatically generated passwords that are really, really hard, you know, different symbols and letters and numbers and whatnot. And I don't know what any of them are. They're all in my password manager. And I have a really hard password for my password manager that only I know, right? And that's, if you want to be secure in your accounts, that's what, and it's cheap. It's like, I think $80 a year for my whole family for a password manager. And it's not one shared password. Everybody gets their own for that same account. And then if there's any shared accounts for family, they're all together. So, and can AI break that? It's not worth it to AI. The amount of compute power it takes would be more expensive than anything they could get out of me. So that's number one. Number two is AI as a scam creator or a civilization mover. For example, if you, please don't, but if you have TikTok, you probably think Hamas is fine. And you know why? Because Hamas is paid, hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to skew the algorithm of TikTok to make Israel some horrible murdering regime and Hamas just be a bunch of freedom fighters who are just trying to make, you know, Palestinians free. Meanwhile, Hamas has killed more Palestinians than any other group in the world.
Right.
And is still actively killing Palestinians. You'd never know that because AI is telling you to think in a different way and conditioning you in a different way. And so know that we are human beings. We are moldable. And AI can be one of the instruments of molding us. So guard your thoughts and minds and know that AI, for good or bad, is trying to figure out exactly how your brain works. And to you as an individual, gear things for you for the general purpose it's trying to do for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of individuals. All these Columbia students that are out there literally cheering on murderers, they are doing that not because they had thought it in the past or were educated to that. It's because their skulls full of mushes that AI and advertising have warped their way of thinking so that they don't know that they are cheering on murder. Right. So, and I'm being very blunt about that. So that's how things, I'll say it, I'll go that far. That's how the National Democratic Socialist Party of Germany in the 1930s changed the mindset, only they had to do it the hard way. If they had AI today, we would probably be, you know, we would have had all of Europe willingly surrender to them as opposed to having that horrible war.
Right.
Right. So AI as a force multiplier, again, can be a force for good or bad. The difference being is you may not know that it is that force is being acted upon you.
That's good.
That's a cybersecurity issue as well as a societal issue.
You're absolutely right. And you segued into my next note was TikTok.
Yeah, just don't do it, right? And you may say, I don't care. I don't have anything to protect. Everything that's on your phone
goes to the Chinese government.
Including your bank accounts, including your passwords, including your kids' names, including your kids' pictures. The Chinese will know it. And not only do they know what they look like today, when they are 30 or 40, those pictures will still be in their database and they'll be able to do past regression and they'll be able to steal your kids' identities and they will be able to manipulate your kids based on what they know about their upbringing. Get off of TikTok and anything like it.
Now, on that subject, though, and here's my dilemma, okay? Because, yes, I preach against TikTok. I say preach, not from the pulpit, but, you know, as a cybersecurity, because I'm aware of that. I will admit that I did create a TikTok account for my podcast because that's where the young ministers are. They go to TikTok now more than they go to YouTube.
Yeah. So, therein is the rub, right? The digital crack, right? That's what we used to call it, digital crack. You know, you get them a little bit hooked and then you overlook all the bad because of the addictive nature of what you get out of it. And make no mistake about it, TikTok or Facebook Reels or one of the,
right,
the shorts, Facebook Reels
and YouTube,
and YouTube shorts. That's all TikTok, but fed through their engine.
Right.
The reason that you will doom scroll for hours is because it is built. The AI is there literally forcing known psychological changes, dopamine, literally your own glands creating an addictive drug, right? A type of morphine,
right,
to your body and brain. And so you don't realize that it is shifting the way you are, what you're looking at and how you're looking at it, tiny step by tiny step, because it is physically addicting to you as well as psychosomatically addicting you to it. So when the quote-unquote young minister or young person or 30-year-old or 50-year-old, doesn't matter, begins an engagement with that type of material, and I'm guilty too on YouTube shorts. I found myself one Saturday morning, it's like 11 o'clock, and I've been there since 7 a.m. I'm like, what in the world happened?
Okay.
It's built to be addictive. And so guard your thoughts, number one. Begin to realize what are the things you are now seeing that you would not have looked at 2 weeks ago, let alone 2 months ago, right? The other is, it's not just what's addictive to you, it's what others want you to get addicted to. I may not have ever thought about looking at this, but there might be one curious little interjection. I'm like, oh, that's curious. I'm a little, you know, and then you'll see it again, a reinforcement function. And then you'll see something a little bit more than that, adding on to that reinforcement function. So It's called an Overton window. It's trying to psychologically move you into a new place that you would have never gone to except for that step by step and step moving of the window of your psychological attention and acceptability.
But that didn't speak to my question or point, though. But that's where the audience is.
Well, that's where the audience is. So, all right, let's talk about that.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do. I do. There it is, the rub, okay? Because you will not be the... You need the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you need the audience to not be in a place that's going to harm them.
True, yeah.
So my church literally is, we rent a strip, you know, two parts into a strip mall. And the building next to us is one of the only two bars in town, right? And every Sunday morning, I have to clear up beer cans and bottles and, you know, food left around. I've had heroin that I've had to pick up in front of my Sunday school door and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And I'm not saying, you know, I live in a very posh town, right? So the fact that I have to do this in my church bothers me. At the same time, I've thought about, I need to open up, you know, an addiction class, but am I going to do that right next to a bar? Right. And so therein is the problem, right? Where is the audience? And at the same time, do I want that audience still in the middle of that addictive environment? You understand
the
difficulty there? Mm-hmm. And I'm not giving you an answer of what to do opposite it, but what I certainly don't want to do is attract an audience to a place where it will be harmful to them.
I get it.
Yeah. So little example, bad example. I come from Schenectady, New York, right? So back in the early 80s, S.R. Hanby advertised on a local television station when it was forbidden to advertise at the United Pentecostal Church. And he actually, an apostle of God, had his license revoked because he was advertising on television. And I thought, what a travesty, you know, absolute travesty. And I would say it was. And yet at the same time, that apostle of God said, they can't hurt me. Because I started all these churches, I've done all these things and whatnot, and they did. Well, the result of that was two things. Number one, his family went off into la-la land on TV and, you know, professional ministry and attracted to all the stuff that TV tells you about instead of apostolic truth and, you know, the not just our doctrine, but truly the converting power of Jesus instead of you can get a big audience and a lot of money, right? And so by being in the realm of where that addiction will always drive you to, he lost his family, right? And at the same time, if he had attracted people from outside of that addiction into that addictive realm, would have brought all of them into that negative as well. And so, again, what is the motivator of the environment where you're trying to pull people out of, as opposed to, I'm going to be here and I'm actually going to pull people into it? Right. So there's one of the, I'm going to have a snippet over there, but it's the real content is going to be in another platform. Maybe that's an answer. Maybe it's not. I'm not sure. But be assured, anytime you interact in that addictive environment, it's going to try to addict you as well with its motivators. So just be conscious of that. I don't have all the answers there.
Yeah, I feel dirty. And right now, I don't browse TikTok just because I'm not interested. I go in long enough to make my ad and or post it, but I worry about it.
Yeah, it's a difficulty. So I used to, when I worked in Africa, they have a saying there that Africa has no plan for China, but China has a plan for Africa.
Yeah.
Right. And so these platforms that generate money by keeping you hooked on them, you might not have a plan for them or not want their end result, but rest assured, they have that plan for you. So just, and look, you're not going to be able to tell your people, don't go on Facebook, don't go on TikTok, don't go on this. Even though I tell everybody, don't go on TikTok, right? It's going to rip you off. It's going to steal your time, your money, your soul.
All right.
At the same time, people are going to do what they're going to do, but we should not, we should be very cautious about leveraging the platform that we know is motivated to harm the individuals that we're trying to help.
I suppose. We'll see. Does that about wrap up our introduction to AI?
I think from an introduction standpoint, look, at the end of the day, there's a couple warnings I would give folks. Number one, if you preach against AI, you're preaching against the future and the present. And all of your people, including you, if you're listening to this podcast, AI is touching you. If you speak on a phone, even a dumb flip phone, AI is watching you, is interacting. If you have a bank account, AI is working on your bank account right now. If you have an investment, AI is looking over your investment. You will not get away from it, right? It is the machine that is multiplying the productivity of humanity. So recognize it simply as a machine that can do good or can do evil, but it's just a machine. It has no conscience. It has no motivation. It has no goal. People do. And they're using the machine for that purpose. That's number one. Number two, you don't have to be an expert, right? Even to talk about it with your friends or whatnot. I remember years ago when I was at Netscape, I knew I was in the right place when I was sitting after church one Sunday and there were three grandpas sitting. I was in my 20s. Three grandpas sitting in the booth on the other side. I was eating my burger and they were eating theirs and they were talking about, yeah, I got my AOL and I sent an email to my grandkids and, you know, I was reading this article and I thought, yep, this thing's going to make a go of it, right? This I'm in the right place when grandpa is talking about using the internet. Well, we're there with AI already, right? So understand it can be a force for good for you and you don't have to be an expert about it and your people are all using it for good or bad, whether they know they're using it or not. And then the third is this. If you are of a mind that I would like to see how we as a people, right, not just the United Pentecostal Church or as Assemblies of the Lord Jesus Christ or the Pentecostal Assembly of the World or whichever other organization you may belong to, I want this truth to be known 1,000 years from now or 100 years from now or 50 years from now. What do I need to give to the world that AI can read, that AI can consume, not just videos of me preaching on Sunday morning, but what is actually something people can use as source material, reference material? Because if people can use that, AI can read it and can make it valuable to generations now and generations to come and publish it to the world, put it out on the internet, put it where, and then go to AppStock Answers or go to ChatGPT yourself if you got your own account and upload the document, right? Or point to the URL and say, read this URL. And this is talking about this subject from an apostolic viewpoint or from a oneness viewpoint or from a Pauline Polycarp viewpoint so that it's able to associate it with it. I'll close with this, right? A historical statement. If you go to the Church of Gesù in Rome, right? It is a magnificently gorgeous building. The building roof is actually painted in three dimensions. It is unbelievable to behold. It was, you know, created in the 1600s, and yet it's three-dimensional painting. The marble work and the sculpture work is magnificent. The gold that fills that building is recorded on a plaque at the feet of Ignatius Loyola's casket, which is there. Church of Gesù is the church, head church of the Jesuits. In the 1600s, our people were carried down in the basement of that church and tortured for what we believed. The gold that fills there comes from our people in Spain because the Spanish Inquisition was against the apostolics and against the Jews, the Sabellinists, they say, in Spain. That was us, right? They wiped us out. They bled us dry. And you know that because at the foot of Ignatius Loyola, there's a plaque that says that this church is built to the glory of God and the remembrance of our triumph over the Sabellinists throughout Spain and Iberia, right? So there is a hostile witness to our testimony of time in the land where Paul brought the gospel, where others brought the gospel, and it preserved all the way up until the 1600s, till quite literally they murdered us out of existence. And the reason I'm saying that is because you can't go find our writings in Spain because they burned them all.
Right.
Okay. Now, imagine if not just a hostile witness, but the writings that we not only are here, but have been here, where we go back and we find the scant writings of the Quakers in the late 1600s, early 1700s, all the way into the early 1800s. They baptized in Jesus' name. They preached about one God. They were filled with the Holy Ghost and spoke in tongues. You wouldn't know that if you read Quaker writings in the 1890s, where they had become pietists and quietists. If our record is now fed to artificial intelligence, it will last 10,000 years, or as how long until the Lord comes back, and will be part of the human knowledge and can be propagated. They believed this. And when I see it in the Bible, I know I can believe this. We are at that point where, though we still are a minority in the state church mentality, we have the ability to make an outsized influence, just as the early church did all the way up until, well, even through the Nicene period, where they wiped us out again. And yet that underground or that secondary, the persecuted church still had a voice, except now our voice can exist throughout time because of AI. And so I encourage people, please post your work, not just videos of your preaching, but your sermon notes, your class notes, your writings, your postulations, your podcasts, your blogs, you name it. Get it out there and feed it to ChatGPT, feed it to Google, feed it to whatever AI you're talking to, so that it becomes part of the human knowledge that's accessible anywhere, any language in the world.
I guess we'll have to demonstrate how to do that when we do our demonstration.
Great idea.
Because I don't know how to do that. All right. Well, I appreciate you. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed it. Be looking forward to the demonstration. I don't know yet if that'll be a live event or just a recorded. We'll just have to work that out and see. I think last time we talked about it, you had a third party in mind. You mentioned getting someone else involved.
Oh, sure. We've got a bunch. So I will say the Apostolic Chamber of Commerce pulled together about 6 or 8 of us that are in, you know, senior positions or experienced positions in artificial intelligence. We had a working group that we've talked to. The funny thing is we all knew each other. And so here we are now with outside witnesses watching our conversation, which was quite nice. So we can have any one of those individuals, or maybe even together those individuals, you know, show some of the examples of what to do. And then on top of that, you know, I think it'd be nice to get their viewpoints of some of the advantages of leveraging AI. The other, I will say, and I will credit her, Tennille Whaley, who's now at Microsoft, created a Facebook page on practical use of AI in the church. And so I would encourage you, if you're on Facebook, you know, go register. Don't be a skull full of mush. Ask good questions. I say that because she made me a moderator, and I don't need to ask, you know, answer. I'm not the church's IT guy, but you can learn stuff there and add to the volume, right? It's not just, you know, one person that gets to speak, but learn how to leverage AI first for the every week or everyday church work that you need to do, and then learn how it can expand to be something more that can live beyond us.
Do you remember the name?
No, I'm not on Wi-Fi at the moment, so it's Apostolic something.
Yeah, there's a lot of Apostolic somethings. Yeah. I'm on Wi-Fi now from my phone.
Mike Behind the Mic is now Mike Behind the Facebook page, looking it up. So
yeah, but I'm on Wi-Fi, but I still can't get it to come up.
Well, put it in the link in the podcast on whatever.
Yeah,
whatever.
That's what I'm going to have to do, because I haven't. I asked a few questions, but I haven't been on the page in a minute, so I don't know. But it's Apostolic.
So I think it's Apostolic Innovation Group is what I think it is. But again, put the link in the podcast. I will say
it is Apostolic Innovation Group.
So Tennille, Sister Whaley, put together a very good podcast. We have it pinned to that page for right now that talks about AI in general and its practical uses in the church. I will say her husband, Tyler, Pastor Whaley, put together a number of series leveraging AI to do some of the hard work. I've posted a few things on there, not videos, but some of the things that I've done with it. And look, we are looking for folks that want to do some innovation. So at any age, you don't have to be 20 to be, you know, the up and comer in AI. You can be 50 plus like me, or you can be 30 plus like Sister Whaley, or you can be, you know, the 20-year-old or the 70-year-old. All of us have something that we can bring to the table that adds value.
She only 30? Man, I feel old. Yeah, all right. Hey, okay. I'm trying to think while I got you here. This is a rare treat for me. I do appreciate you coming on. I always appreciate your friendship. You've been very kind to me, very, very helpful, and I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.